Welcome to Symptomatic Redness, a podcast for those who are pathologically interested in history, critical theory, philosophy, aesthetics, or anything that may inform the modern world.
Today, we have a conversation between me, C. Derek Varn, and my co-host, Amogh Sahu, on some theoretical, historical, or philosophical point of the left.
In all the interviews, sometimes people forget that you are actually the co-host of this show. You wanted to talk about a bunch of stuff today that we actually recorded a 3-hour long show that we didn't save. And while today we won't be going for 3 hours, you are going to start recording more regularly with me, correct?
I'd like to do that.
All right. And so Amogh, who's been here since the beginning, since before we were part of Zero Books, is back.
And yep, I'm back.
You wanted to talk about... What did you want to talk about? We talked about so much that last time that we lost the recording for.
So the kind of banner heading was "Can we transcend identity," which was supposed to be a sort of banner for a few different topics. The most specific kind of concrete reference was this kind of particular identities versus universalist class politics debate. But then that kind of mushroomed onto this broader debate about kind of Marxism's liberal roots and whether it's possible for any universalist project to succeed, you know, any project that aims to get rid of contradictions to succeed. And then we kind of just ended up talking about it became a conversation about optimism versus pessimism about the contemporary left. So that I think was the rough 3-stage progression last time.
I am still kind of a pessimist. Right. This is the.
Yeah.
But I am not. The thing that you were surprised by and you've realized in the last year is I'm a pessimist, but I am not like a fatalist or a.
Nihilist.
Or a nihilist who just thinks it's all meaningless. Like, are there any action you do is doomed because it's not coming from a theoretically perfect place, or that engaging with reformist or imperfect, you know, Leninist or whatever kind of politics is inherently doomed. Although I will tell you that you're talking to me on a day where I'm less sanguine about it than the last time we talked, just because of events between now and then. So
right. I mean, to start with, we can I think skip the identity politics class aspect of it, because that kind of quickly disappeared and we started talking about broader stuff. And we can put the question pretty easily, which is that, you know, the puzzle is this, that Marxism as a species of a sort of liberal project is fundamentally optimistic about the ability of human beings to come together and dissolve a certain kind of contradiction, right? The particular contradiction in the means of production. As you and I have said many, many, many times, this doesn't mean that all contradictions go away. So I think our listeners are probably tired of hearing that, but it needs to be said. So it has a very specific reason for this faith, right, which is supposed to be, quote, objective and sociological, that you know, as capitalism develops, it will be its own gravedigger. There's going to be this organized opposition, which is going to ensure that this prophecy becomes kind of objective sociological fact. And last time you asked me this question about whether I did believe this story, and I said no, and you were somewhat surprised, either somewhat surprised or somewhat taken aback by that.
Yeah, well, the great question of our show, in a way, for these 5 years now.
yeah, absolutely. We started in 2014.
It's whether or not either one of us are actually Marxist. Is anyone actually a Marxist? Was Marx actually a Marxist? why are all the people who claim to be Marxist kind of keep on coming off to be incomplete in some way? Like there is a truth that when Douglas Lane says the history of Marxism is about the abandonment of Marx and Engels' ideas, but I would go so far to say that is even true for Doug.
But he hears that in a certain way that, like, those ideas are still available. They've just kind of been thrown aside, right?
Right. It's a voluntaristic reading that if we just believed more, the one more good college try reading. And maybe it's my Adornian sense. Maybe it's the fact that I am historicist. Like, I don't think value theory alone, which is what Doug rests all that claim on, actually, because he only is interested in one element of Marxist work when you really get down to it, or maybe two. He wouldn't see it that way, but then I don't think you actually, I don't really think you solve most of these problems, even with a coherent view of that. Like, you and I both started off participating in a reading on Kleiman's critique of the Schafferins and all that stuff, right? And
yeah.
I came away thinking differently from you, but I thought, oh, Kleiman's right, but this isn't most of what Marxism is. This is a very specific sub-question related to a very specific reading of capitalism, in which Kleiman is explaining something fundamental to Marxism, but is not the entirety of the thing. Marxism is larger than just its economic coherence.
I totally agree with that. I mean, I'm surprised that you said I think somewhat differently from you.
Well, you that's were frustrated exactly, with the yeah. conversation more than I was.
Like, oh, that's true. That's definitely true.
Like, you thought that it either wasn't completely honest, or it was completely honest, but much smaller and less important than the people involved in the conversation thought.
Yes, but my reasons for that were basically what you just said right now, that like that there was this assumption that I termed that, you know, that the reason Marxism had fallen out of favor over the last 50 years was because of these particular controversies about, you know, simultaneism or not. And I think that that's just wrong. That's at the very least not the only reason.
I don't think it's even the primary reason. I think actually simultaneism, the controversy about simultaneism or timed, is actually a result of why Marxism's falling out of favor, not the cause. And some of the big questions that weren't resolved by that is, does Marx have a coherent theory of money once you get outside of explicitly commodity money?
Right.
And honestly, if all you've read of Capital Volume 1, you wouldn't be able to answer that, because mm-hmm. that's not even dealt with till Capital Volume 2. And Marx has two theories of money, commodity money and credit money. And the debate between Marxists really is now, is the modern economy based on credit money, or is it some way still commodity money, or is there this third category in which Keynesianism is true and modern money is neither thing?
Right.
So, like...
And if Keynesianism is true, when and where is it true? Under what conditions? What role does imperialism play? Blah-de-blah. You know, that sort of stuff.
Well, yeah, those open up a completely different set of questions. And people are always shocked that I see, like, post-Keynesians and stuff as allies, but I also think in some ways they're more dangerous to the project than, say, libertarians actually are.
Right. So just to get back to this point you made a second ago about Marxism being more than the economics, I feel like people don't kind of get that enough. The idea they have this kind of rationalist kind of view that, look, the economics gives us the problem, and then, you know, then there's a question of quote-unquote political will. Which is basically to be thought about in terms of people, you know, getting their shit together enough to look at the facts.
So when you really take things apart right now, I think you have to look at two different things. There are two dominant trends, and our friends tend to be given to what would be called economism trend, you know, which is this idea that the economics is a dominant, that it is, that when you say material-based society and you say economics, they mean the same thing. And then there's a counter trend that's actually, I think, really more popular in the left right now, particularly after the resurgence of Trump, which is political determinism, which is that the relationship of Marxists to the state is actually the primary thing. The economics is subordinate to that, as long as there's planning.
Right.
And
so could you name a few names here, or name a few currents of thought or something?
All Marxist center people, which is a very small but increasingly growing thing. All Maoists pretty much believe this. Most MLs believe this. The rise of internet Stalinism. Probably half of the DSA that's more radical believes exactly what I just said there. And also social democrats in the main actually believe that too. They just don't see revolution as necessary to it. So So the anytime when you subsume the act of the class into the party, you got an issue. And it's one of the things you have to think about Marx about. Marx thinks political parties are important, but he rarely ever talks about them. That's the subordination of class to party. That is a post-Lenin thing that you see in Lenin, you see in the MLs, which are really Stalinist, you see in Maoist, you see in even ultra-leftists like Bordigas. So political determinism, the idea that we can politically determine the entirety of society because you can manage the social base that way, is also kind of the dialectically opposed error to economism. The end of the day, though, they're both errors.
Absolutely.
They are favoring one side of a dialectical tension over another. And I would even say, even though I think the economism is like in some ways more dangerous than political determinism, I also think in some ways it's more right, even though it's wrong. But like if you're going to weigh society in one way or the other, economics probably does have more influence than politics. Politics hit real limits pretty hard. Now, that's very different than what you and I talked about in the infamous lost tapes. There's going to be all these lost tapes people will be trying to find. But like our infamous review of a riot strike riot, which no one will ever hear.
That was the best. That was the best material we ever did. We'll never top that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's also like, what is it? There's the second episode on cultural Marxism. Anyway, to get back on topic. So this leads me to this kind of soft pessimism about the project. But the thing is that I have to deal with is I think Adorno, there was a big turn to Adorno in the Obama years amongst a certain group of people. And then there, a lot of those same people have now, like, they become rabidly anti-Adorno because Adorno can make you feel like there's nothing you can do. There's no political will. And I actually do think that is an error in Adorno's thinking, that he totalizes the negativity to the point where there really is no way out. But Adorno, to me, his dialectic of enlightenment question is still the primary question, because it reminds you that modernity is not just capitalism. Capitalism is the most dominant thing in modernity because it dominates, you know, how we produce the base of society, or to use normal people speak, it's how we make stuff, it's how we make society go, it's how we feed ourselves. But it's not the only thing. It's never been the only thing. And thus, Marxism's relationship to modernity is questionable, because we're not anti-modern. The extent of our believing other parts of the modern project seems to vary depending on time and place and who's speaking. And I'm going to be honest, it's not even totally clear to me what Marx and Engels ultimately think on all of this. Like, if they still bought into all of it by the time of their death. I really don't totally know. I know that Engels's critique of Kautsky, when Kautsky was still alive, and Kautsky took this to heart, was that they over-relied on the state and the government for far too much. Which is funny, right? Because I associate people as Engelians, right, who are Kautskyists, right, and all this stuff. But at the end of the day, they were talking about socialism because socialism was larger than statism, not because the state wasn't necessary to this project or you could simply abolish it or get rid of it, but because, like, some of these things are larger than the state or than any state control.
Right. They're the international problems.
Well, they're beyond international problems. That's not just the... Because, look, you could have an international state that solved this, right? If that was the only question. But it's not the only question. Like, a mega state doesn't fix the problem. The problem is how society is produced. And you have to get into other questions. Well, what is society? And the issue is, when you talk about society, you're talking about, when you like to use that vague and frankly kind of problematically reductivist Marx speak about base and superstructure. But society is both the base and the superstructure. So the state is part of it. But it's not.
Right.
It is not the determinant of it. Neither is, like, the culture, whatever that is, that's harder to pin down. And honestly, neither even is the class. Like, class society, you know, class society, and Marx and Engels talk about class society, not, like, just the class state, which is something that's important to remember. But class society is what dominates society, because class is how we divide up how we reproduce ourselves. But it isn't the even that's not the totality of everything. It's just the it is just the limiting or determining factor. So all history is the history of class society, but that class society can change. So no one right. So when there's a social shift, mm-hmm. when you have an epochal change, the class nature of society has changed. One of the differences between Marxists and anti-modernist reactionaries is anti-modernist reactionaries don't think the fundamental nature of a class changes.
Right. But it seems like there is a fundamentally modern conviction at the heart of at least like a lot of Marxist theory, in that there's a view that society will evolve in such a way as to promote the interests of all mankind in the end.
It depends on how you read the Brumaire. It depends on whether or not you think Marx thinks that is necessary or possible. And those are
right.
Those are actually profoundly different things. If you say necessary, I think the 20th century is a long... The best you can say is it's a long detour. The worst is actually up at hand.
I mean, I was going for the possibility claim, but that's an open question.
Well, yeah. So what do you mean about the possibility claim? Like...
The thought is that the development of the capitalist mode of production will provide people the resources. I mean, this is the vague way I'm phrasing it right now, to overthrow capitalism, right? It'll allow interests to align in a particular way that it's, you know, at, I guess almost at a sociological level that it will be objectively possible to build anti-capitalist power.
So I would say, yeah, that's true. The
right.
The issue is whether or not you think it's going to automatically do so.
Right.
I mean, to me, that's actually a subtle distinction, but it's a huge distinction between Marxists. Like, and you think, oh, reform or revolution. This doesn't, that question still exists. So it takes two forms. The Bernsteinite is it'll just evolve into socialism, right?
Right.
But the Soviet Marxist-Leninist model is that no, it'll necessitate revolution. Necessitate, it will happen. You see Khrushchev beating his shoe at the United Nations. He believes this. It's not a matter of that case that the another world is possible for them either. It's that, oh, capitalism is producing its own gravediggers, and whether or not you believe it's going to evolve out or revolution out, you still think it is pretty much inevitable. And to me, both on a potentiality scale and a public history sort of scale, I don't know how you maintain that. But what I do think is true is the productive capacity for something beyond capitalism to exist already exists. The question is going to be, what is it? And it might not... this is the thing that people should take to heart. It might not be communism.
Right. I mean, it's useful to note that this kind of one way of reading the necessary possible debate historically is that you could see the new left as having a version of this like possible view, right? Which is like, well, there isn't going to be the static evolutionary transition, but we have all of these, I don't know, disenfranchised groups and I don't know, communes and things like that, which are going to ensure that capitalist transition is possible. Even if it wasn't historically necessitated.
Right. So you have the loss of faith in the historical necessity, but really, if you're really honest about the loss of faith in the historical necessity, it doesn't date back to the New Left. It dates back to 1918.
Yes.
When the German Revolution goes disastrously, and a lot of right-wingers say this, too, and they're not entirely wrong, what you have is the end of faith of the automaticity of all this stuff. But the thing is, it's not even clear to me that Marx and Engels believed in the automaticity of it. I mean, if it was automatic, why would you need any of the theories and any of the class politics and the coalitionist ideas and all this that they came up with?
Right.
It would have been self-evident. And I've talked many, many years about one of the biggest gaps of Marxism is that Marx and Engels have a very Enlightenment notion of the human mind, which I actually don't entirely reject myself, but they also just assume it. Like, I used to talk about early on that, like, when you read Marx, it's very hard to get his conception of the human concept out unless you read a lot between the lines. And if you, like, hold Althusserian notions or something, then you're going to reject where he actually talks about it, because it's early on. It's in early writings. But when he talks about species being in human nature, which he does talk about, despite all the, you know, heterodox academy people say Marx, you know, Marxists and leftists don't believe in human nature. He says there is a human beingness, just like there is a dog beingness, but we're so mitigated by history, it's almost impossible to know what it is because we can't see it directly.
And it sort of has to get rediscovered in historical evolution and transformation or something.
Right. And also elements of it are contingent on, like, part of the human nature is its contingency on sociological conditions that are specific to a particular time period.
Right.
So, like, I mean, in some ways, Marx was one of the first people to say the nature-nurture debate or the environmental, social, biological debate. It's just those categories are too muddled. You can't separate them out. So whenever we talk about human nature, it's impossible to know from our own, because, you know, what he says, if you want to learn a dog being, you watch a dog in their natural environment, right? Well, we even with the example from biology with dogs or wolves, right? We now know that wolf pack culture is very different in captivity, where we initially studied it, than in the wild. So, like, alpha, beta dog stuff is not true in wolf packs in the wild. That structure is more rigid in captivity. Actually, if anyone's ever lived in a human prison, you see similar things, right? But which means even in, like, mammals that are not as linguistically complicated as us, you can see that the historical conditions actually changes some of their natural relationships. I mean, and this is not even getting to, like, the physical and philosophical concepts about what's actually natural, if the concept of natural is even useful. But once you really start pinning this down, you realize, like, and I talk about this, like, I believe that there is a human nature, but I will not tell you what it is.
Because you don't know.
I don't know. I cannot separate out.
Sorry, the way you phrased it as if you were keeping it from us.
No, but sorta. I mean, like, look, I know more than say you could have known in Ingalls' time. I mean, Ingalls is interesting because he really does try to do this, and he ends up with, like, Lamarckianism filling in the gaps. He talks about some wild stuff, but he also hits on stuff that's fundamentally true. Like the first divisions, once you get out of hunter-gatherer society, are sex divisions because they're divisions of labor. But that in hunter-gatherer society, that's not as relevant. Now, again, when you actually dig deep in this difference of anthropology, one of the things you realize is generalizations about hunter-gatherer society are almost wrong because hunter-gatherer societies are much more plural in how they structure themselves than we tend to realize, even in currently existing times. So when you're trying to project that back on societies that no longer exist, it's almost impossible to know. But it does seem in general that, like, Ingalls was right that the division of labor within the family, as opposed to kind of kin tribe division of labor in the hunter-gatherer society, led to the first class divisions, and they were gendered. All right, but that's pre-capitalist. This is actually my problem with social reproduction theory: is it tends to place things in capitalism that are actually far deeper than that. So I could talk about that, but I could also say that, like, so there's a real difference between sexes and genders. But those differences are also fluid and change over time. Like, when you study societies, they just are. Like, you know, I'm not even making, like, you know, a big point about modern, you know, gender politics. This is literally just an anthropological statement of fact. Like, once there are a limited number of arrangements that you can come up with in an agricultural society for division of labor between physically dimorphous, you know, mammals. But there's a bunch of them, actually.
And
there's a limit to it, but there's a bunch of them, and it caused inequity between the sexes and how they were reified.
So the needs point earlier on you brought up is actually quite useful, because it helps say something about how complex all the stuff that we need to have in place is before revolutionary change or any sort of positive the transformation of motor production. You know, people have to have the right conceptions, whether that means not only class conceptions, they got to have some conception of their needs. You know, there have to be these objective conditions. It shouldn't just be in principle possible. that there is this other mode of production. There's got to be some route that, I mean, all this doesn't have to happen at the same time, but, you know, over time, presumably, there's got to be some route that you can take to get there, right? So, I mean, it shouldn't be, as it were, sort of hypothetical on a model that, you know, using some idealized recombination of factors of production and resources now that we can have a more productive system. There's got to be some way that a group of people can, using existing resources, get there, right? And all of this presumably doesn't just line up automatically.
No, and it doesn't. Also, this is where a certain element of my left communism comes in. It also doesn't already totally exist within a class.
Yes.
So, like, for example, the working class, just because it's the working class, and we can't even agree on what that is now, you know, really, is not innately already able to separate from this. This is a left communist point, but it's one that I think is true. Like,
yeah.
Like, and it's not even like, it's a left communist point. It's also one that Lenin actually, like, realized that, like, trade union and trade union consciousness was necessary, but also a hard limit because it's going to always preserve itself, which means it actually preserves the relationship to capital. But if you just go in and with the ultra left comm stance of, like, condemning trade unions or whatever, it's like you're dead off the bat because you just seem like a crazy radical. You know, like, there's no, the left comm error in my mind is its abandonment of stagism for, like, immediate and other revolution in all areas. And even Trotskyists who get accused of this, they actually still get it. That's why they have their transitional program. As much as I don't really like their framework of the transitional program or agree with what their traditional program traditionally was, I do think they still understand this. Where some left communists, like, will call for, like, you know, die off or collapse or whatever, so that society simplified enough that they could uniformly across the board, you know, change everything at once.
But there's no guarantee that any Marxist schema of any of their schema at this point would apply to the collapsed society, so that you could exercise any control over it.
Right. Well, the other thing is that left communist, even though it's associated with economic determinism, ends up being functionally political determinism. This is something that people don't see. There is a dialectical flip that happens where one of these things becomes the other, right? So, like, you instigate collapse so you could have other political determinism.
Right, because when collapse happens, then some enlightened group is going to be able to do the right things.
Right, well, but and you point out the problem with that. You're not the only group. So, like, and also, like, because when capitalism fails, you can't depend on the working class and capitalism to act in their interest because that doesn't exist anymore.
Right, you've destroyed the sociological basis for your own revolution.
Correct. This is also true of accelerationism, by the way. Like, so.
Absolutely.
So all these are, like, easy answers for a very hard problem. And one of the reason why I'm more pessimistic these days on some questions, I'm not pessimistic ultimately about Marxism, but pessimistic about any immediate horizon for it, even though I'm also going to say we need an immediate horizon for something or
climate change.
Yeah. Although I'm going to be slightly heretical right now and say I take climate change very seriously. I actually don't think it's going to wipe out the human race. Like, I don't.
It doesn't have to do that to be horrible.
No. I actually I think it's going to be collapse, you know, civilizational collapse scale bad, but it's not an extinction event for us. Probably. That's still crappy. I mean, like,
civilizational collapse doesn't sound so great.
Well, this is what I want people to do. There's an obsession that Marxists have with modern. They essentially, a lot of Marxists are really bad at looking at anything before capitalism, or, you know, outside of their notions of feudalism, which they often, I'm going to be completely honest, have a very simplistic understanding of how it actually worked, based off of 17th century scholarship. So, like, if you look at the long collapse of antiquity, because you have to ask yourself, and the question I always ask myself, materially speaking, why couldn't Rome transition to the Enlightenment? All right? You needed Roman ideas to make the Enlightenment possible. You did. You need Greek ideas, too. But why couldn't they do it? One is they use slaves the way we use technology and reinvestment. So an expropriatus, so that answers one question. But They had pretty advanced technology. I mean, they lost a lot of it in the collapse. So what's the other issue? And the issue is they didn't think about human labor in a way that allowed them to change their modes of development in a way that wouldn't collapse into, you know, various kinds of manorialism, feudalism, Asiatic despotism. I don't like that term, but I'm just using Marx's term right now. It's one of the terms I think Marx wasn't very good on because he just slammed too many different things together. But the reason why that happens is because you have the potential for a system change, and that system change can't be conceived of, or there's some material element missing, or both. So you have this misalignment there, and you actually do have contraction and failure. Now, the Dark Ages, quote-unquote, weren't as bad as everyone thinks they were, but let's also not do this whole modern thing where we romanticize them. They were still pretty bad. Like,
absolutely.
You have a massive loss of human knowledge. You had a fair amount of massive loss of human life, at least in the initial transition. It took 400 years to kind of for things to get back on their feet. Yes, it ended an imperial system, but it created a bunch of other ones that only a religion could fill the gap of. And that's the other thing is people are like, oh, well, Rome fell. But I'm like, yeah, but there were other empires. They're just not associated with European ones. And also thinking of the Roman Empire as the paradigmatic European empire is actually a 17th century mistake. Like, so, you know, the
mention of religion is very useful because it's important to note that we have the McIntyre problem still on the table. Right, which is we aren't going to get anywhere with an abstract production schema, right? Even if that's hard enough, but we also need, you know, call it what you like, a form of life, an ethics, whatever, a conception of virtue, or something like that.
Well, yeah, you need. I am always skeptical of totalizing teleologies, and I know there's Marxists who love them, and I tend to be like no, but you do need a conception of goods for which you are developing. What does that civilization need? What does it not need? My argument with a lot of Marxists right now is that for reasons that I think are smart, they incorporate a lot of liberal modern values. I don't think they're all bad. I don't think, unlike a lot of, it's funny to me because a lot of the people who talk the most about how bad liberals are also are fundamentally liberal in their assumptions.
You're talking about like American conservatives, right?
Yeah, but also Maoist, European and American Maoist, you know, combat liberalism, but they follow every like lifestyle liberal trend because they're not, you know, not really dealing with contradictions. They're looking at things purely in very simplistic notions of oppressed and non-oppressed peoples. You know, like the first world, third world debates, you know, which get kind of expressed a little better in world systems theory, but even world systems theory, like they start hedging their bets on China and all this stuff in ways that are sketchy. You know, like you're going to tell me that China's part of periphery when it has the largest productive capacity on the planet and can kind of, it's the only place that can kind of can set terms even on the United States. That's part of the periphery, not the core of the economy. That's just, you're stuck in the 60s, buddy. Like the core has moved,
right? I mean, I think the reason these people are useful to mention is that it's useful to note how much you can get wrong even if you get a lot right, right? So for instance, a lot of these people, Maoists, let's say it's people like left comms, for example, you know, they may have the right objective social analysis, maybe they don't, but they don't have any conception of agency.
Well, of other people's agency.
Of other people's agency.
And there is a tendency amongst left-coms, Maoists, Marxist-Leninists, Althusserians, all kinds of, I know I'm just dropping names of people, but all kinds of groups to think that somehow systems have agencies and not persons, which is backwards.
Whereas one side of the story.
Yeah, I mean, I really think it's backwards. I don't just think it's one-sided. I think choice is limited by things that are beyond any person. And people's aggregate choices matter. But notice that I said aggregate and not collective, even though they kind of mean the same thing. But when people talk about collectivity, they talk about it as if the collective as a whole has a choice. When you talk about aggregates, you realize that it doesn't. That individual choices actually stochastically make up a totalizing system. And your individual choices are limited by things like where you are in that system, which is where your class is. That's what it is. This is like when people do this thing where they talk about collectivism versus individualism, one, that's not just a modern problem, for one thing. That's a myth that it's a purely modern problem. And two, it's not true in either case. There's an African proverb that's really popular amongst some of the different tribal groups in South Africa that I actually do take to heart on this, and I think clarifies this a little bit. You are made a person through other people.
There's obviously the Hegelian thing about recognition, which is slightly different but strikes a similar note.
Well, I mean, I think the Hegelian is this, you know, hermetic Christian, but also kind of actually more philosophically astute recognition of this. But it's something to go back on. Other people, as in other people in your class, other people in other groups, not a system, all right? The system is produced by those interactions. It is the reification of those interactions.
And just because you have to think systemically, right, there's this injunction to think in terms of the totality, doesn't mean you reify the system as an agent.
Right. The system is not an agent. Capitalism does not make decisions. Capitalists do. Like, and I know people have a problem with this, but unless you believe in, like, world spirits in some kind of Gnostic sense, you aren't being a materialist if you talk about systems this way. This is why I ended up rejecting Althusserianism. The way they talk about systems is fundamentally false. It's very neat and clean for trying to do historical analysis and typologies, but that's all it is. If you try to base some politics off of it, you do stuff like talk about democracy and yet get mad at people for not automatically agreeing to your ideological preconceived notions and call it false consciousness or whatever. And not, I don't like the idea of false consciousness in the first place, but you know what? But let's just say that your consciousness is instrumentally limited for some reason. Okay, fine. But sometimes those interests are very real. And they're based off currently existing conditions that you have provided no way for people to get out of. Calling that false consciousness is actually blaming other people for what is essentially your fault. And let's get into this a little bit. Is also because you're talking out of both ends of your mouths about systems. At one sense, they're totally totalizing. I used to come to this logic problem, you know, when I first met you many, many years ago. I mean, met you online when we first started doing this podcast. I used to talk about how, like, well, if you really believe this stuff about systems, how does anything ever change? Because the systems would dominate everything. And then your options are there's some kind of force guiding the systems. And we got to remind ourselves, that's what Hegel believed, that God was guiding these systems and these personalities and these great men into the, you know, the realm of perfect freedom. We forget that, but Hegel did believe that. I mean, I know there's people, like, my big argument with Douglas Lane was whether or not you had to be God to be a real, believe in God would be a real Hegelian, and I ultimately think you do. I don't mean that in, like, to use the Hegelian methodologies, but to actually believe what Hegel believed, you have to believe that there is something absolute that manifests in a negative way, but has a very, very totalizing instinct teleology that is kind of an eschatology, ultimately. So, to speak normal people language, you have to believe that there's a reason why everything is happening that is ultimate, and is only going to develop in one way.
And you're seeing this play out in Althusserianism, yes. Basically.
Even though Althusserian's an anti-Hegelian, he ends up coming to the same spot. I mean, it's important to remember, through his own development, people don't read his pre-structural writings, but I think in the 50s, he was a diehard Hegelian and abandons it later on.
Because he found another system.
Yeah, I mean, he tries to take Saussurean structural analysis and apply it to Marxism. And then he goes back and reads the same. He goes back and finds in reading 9 works of Marx, which is funny in and of itself. He did read them very closely. But in reading only 9 works of Marx, finds an epistemological break that mirrors his own break.
Right. I mean, I think the useful thing about mentioning Althusser is to distinguish the pessimism you can have from that systemic point of view from the pessimism that we're trying to articulate. But I take it that our problem is not that, you know, there is a single thing, the system, which is, you know, not reactive to change or whatever, but rather that there are a number of different routes you could have, all of which have limits. And at the moment, those limits look to be insurmountable. That's a sort of empirical claim that we're making.
Right. And it's not that I think those are insurmountable, but I would say we have no idea what will surmount them. But this is also where I cut with almost all other Marxists I know right now. If anyone tells me they have an answer to this problem that is pre-articulated, I immediately go, you're lying. You do not. If you did, it would have already happened. You do not have it yet. That does not mean we should take the conservative route and, you know, go straw hands up and go like, you know, like Fukuyama in 1985 or whatever, and be like, no, this is the only way there is, and it'll be here forever. Because and Fukuyama's like, you know, the opposite end of this, because he's a liberal in the big L Enlightenment sense, Hegelian. He is a Hegelian who rejects Marxism. And but even he, you know, now he's like kind of he's gone from neoconservative to like soft DSA socialist, right? But kinda, I mean, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would read him more as New Deal liberal or whatever,
DSA socialist, New Deal liberal, that's a hazy line, right? Like, it's right. He thinks he's talking about socialism, we think he's talking about Keynesianism. And depending on who's in the DSA and what chapter you're talking to at any given moment, they might agree with us or him, right? So, but that's also part of the point that I'm trying to make. Like, even in an organization right now, the collectivity is not determined unless you try to determine it from the top. And determining it from the top has its benefits. It's very revolutionarily, structurally easy to pivot. But also, when it's wrong, it can destroy an entire society in three generations.
That's super useful, because it's not. We're not just saying this sort of standard left-com thing about, like, look, well, state power is too strong, the police are too strong, there are objective resource limits. There are also these ideological problems and problems of people's conceptions and problems of, you know, stuff we just don't know, which have nothing to do in the first instance with state power.
Man creates history, but not as he wills it. The idea of Marxism is that we would have freedom to create our own history in a way that we could control. But the issue is, anybody who says we can already do that by means of party or whatever, and I'm not an anti-party Marxist anymore. I've changed my position on that over many years, but I think you have to engage in all of these things. Someone asked me the other day, and this was the theme of our last conversation, right? Like, why both critique the DSA as being right-wing socialist and structurally inept, and yet always talk to them, but I don't join. And I'm like, why would I give money to something I don't entirely support? But also, conversely, since I think you guys think that you're on the right path, why I wouldn't be opposed to helping you? It's not like you're, you know, advocating the destruction of people like me, or the suppression or whatever. Therefore, which, you know, even some Marxist groups would advocate, because we are, you know, we're not on party line or whatever. But the DSA doesn't do that. So why would I have a problem with you? Like, but also, why is my critiquing you seen as an attack on you, and not like just me saying, like, you're wrong about this, or you haven't thought this through? And a lot of times, I'm not even saying I'm right, is that you're claiming something that you can't know, or you're claiming something that like has in the past not worked. Like, this has been tried before, you don't know your own history, which is in America probably the worst. But the thing is, even in places where the left tradition is not as decimated as it was in America, you still see this all the time, where people just double down on stuff that's failed before. I mean, ultimately, right. Like, that's really where I break with Trotskyism. It's like, you doubled it. You've had 100 years. The transitional program was supposed to be immediate. So even if I think Trotsky was the best Bolshevik, I don't, but I do respect him deeply. Like, and I don't think that some of the left-com and Maoist and whatever slurs against Trotsky are silly. But at the end of the day, I also have to go away thinking, like, but that didn't work either. It hasn't happened yet. And it's not just a failure of leadership or the people not being in the, you know, whatever Trot sect. Because you guys can't agree on anything either. And ultimately, all your deviations, you can find a parallel deviation with Malice that match up on the same question, just in slightly different language because of a slightly different tradition, with the weird exception of the PSL and WWP, which are both Marcionite, which are Stalinists who started off as Trotskyists. So, like, in a certain sense, none of you have an answer because you all end up looking like each other.
Like, I mean, and even the stuff that is new, right? The stuff that you mentioned last time we talked as the positive points, like, you know, the new radical trade unionists who are kind of like the, you know, the surprising upshot of the destruction of trade unions. Even there, you know, all we can say is something that is broadly negative, but optimistic only in that it is not full condemnation.
Well, yeah, like you and I have talked about the reemergence of trade union talk. Which is, people misread my critique of unions. I've been attacked by this a lot lately because, you know, I come down kind of skeptical of the NEA and I don't trust AFL-CIO unions and all that. But at the same time, I'm like, but right now, because of the utter errors and failures of the trade unions in the 20th century, you have a generation of people who aren't cynical on unions.
And that's not a bad thing.
That's not a bad thing. And because they're actually also changing the structure of unions. Before the Great Recession, unions systemically screwed over new members. They just did. Like, and I say they just did, they were structurally encouraged to because old members had paid dues for longer. And they could make concessions to protect their older members who had paid dues for longer and were higher up in the union organization than they could the new members. And also, the leadership wasn't paid by dues, it was paid by stock dividends. And so, you know, and you still have some of these problems, and they still do stuff like, you know, they're still largely too loyal to Democrats or whatever. But at the same token, you do have a radical faction within new trade unions, and you've also seen things that have become, you know, until the mid-90s, the IWW was basically a historical reenactment society. I know people are going to hate me for saying that, but I think it's true. I actually do think that is changing. It's still pretty limited. It still can't offer a lot of the stuff it needs to offer to really spread beyond, like, coastal strongholds and very, very, very small businesses. But it is doing something.
And, you know, even if these things grow very far, you know, we still have no solution to the global imperialism and capital flight problem. We still have no solution to blah, 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 blah. But that's no reason to chalk these all off from the beginning.
Right. So, like, you engage with the DSA, it grows super fast. You also have to admit, right off the end, that most DSA politics is incoherent. Its relationship to the Democratic Party is incoherent. But also, most of the answers to that, both inside and outside the DSA, are equally incoherent because they're based off of trying to reproduce 1917-style Bolshevism, our 1920-style Chinese peasant uprising communism, to a historical situation to where even if those things were the right answer at that time, you do not live in those situations.
And the DSA has the virtue of existing.
Right. Well, I mean, well, like, some of these other groups exist in small numbers. And I mean, by small numbers, you can still be upwards of 2,000 or 3,000. They most hit that I've been talking about this all the time, but I want people to really get this in their head. Most left groups, even outside the United States, have a 6,000 member limit. All right? Which is fascinating because, like, a megachurch in a city can beat that. But those are the large groups. The DSA is the exception. But when you think about the DSA, for example, you're still only talking about even, and this is not accounting for the fact a lot of their members are only paper members or low involvement members. But even not accounting for that, you're only dealing with 50, maybe 60,000, which is the hugest organization we've had since the SDS. But in the scale of the United States, it's still tiny. It actually bats above its weight and its influence on the Democratic Party right now.
I mean, it takes a lot from the Justice Democrats and from a lot of other kind of progressive groups just because people like to brand themselves as socialists now.
Yeah. Well, there's also one of the advantages of socialism is also its disadvantage. When it's popular, it gets watered down. I mean, this is also not unique to now. If you look at the heyday of socialism, yellow card unionism, which is racist unionism and stuff that people misidentify as Strasserism. It's funny because now, because something rhymes with fascism, people are calling it fascist. And look, I'm sympathetic to, like, third periodism, which is pointing out that, like, social democracy is structurally similar to fascism, but not as extreme. There's a truth to that. I mean, there's a real truth to that, but like saying that one thing is the other, like outright, is silly.
Right.
It's the same thing with like saying like Obama is structurally similar to Trump, but saying they're the exact same, it like makes everybody who's not like a Marxist look at you like you're insane. So there's that.
Yeah, I was wondering if we could just begin wrapping up, because there's a very natural last question to ask about what our approach is, given all the pessimistic things we've said, right? And you mentioned engaging with the DSA. And I mean, presumably you don't think you can support any group at this time.
I don't. There have been groups that I thought I could support, but ultimately almost none of them have come through in with a clear enough way. They all tend to think they have an answer before they do. They all tend to talk about democracy, but then, you know, not really live up to it. I mean, and this is true of the DSA too. At the end of the day, I feel like you have to be engaged in activity, and I would not begrudge anybody from joining a group. In fact, I'm going to go ahead and say something somewhat many Marxists are going to find heretical. Joining a political sect is probably one of the few ways, particularly before this heyday of left-wing podcasting, right? Because we are living in this right now. But to get a good...
For better or worse.
To get a good education, but ultimately, you're probably going to be frustrated with it and leave it. Maybe you can change it to be better, but almost all of them have a problem of, like, the democracy that established the rules of the organization, that was democratically established, but by a very small group of people who maintain that is binding as the group changes and becomes much more and more large, which is a structural problem, right? Because it means that, like, basically it's a democracy of 9 people who've set the tone for everything and set the rules for everything beyond them. And most people will find that that's how a lot of these sects work. But I'm not going to name names here, but some of the ones that you would think, you know, who do a lot of theoretical publishing work, they actually don't teach their cadres any of it. They just have them go do, like, grunt work for them, which I think is exploitative and cult-like. But, again, it's something you need to do. Most people need to come out of beating their head against the wall in some kind of org for a little while. It's interesting. The other, you know, there's a podcast that I would suggest everyone listen to called Regrettable's History. They're not aligned with me, although they've been on SR a couple times. Well, they interviewed me once, but it was just really long, so it ended up being a couple of episodes. They come out of a Trotskyist orientation, and so there are things I disagree with them about, but they're close to me, and they say the same thing. They had to beat their head against the wall, you know, in the ISO or in Solidarity, and then beat their head against the wall in Occupy, and then kind of they're in the DSA for the most part, but reluctantly. You know, reluctantly joining the DSA because that's where the socialists were, but kind of as critical members. That's what I would suggest people do, because you need to learn. Just hearing me tell you this is not going to do anything except make you a smug asshole. You need to do it, but you need to do it critically and remind yourself that in religion and in politics, if anyone asks you to give yourself completely over without giving you anything for it, you should be wary. Like, if they can deliver, then they can demand more. But if they can't give it to you, then it's not any different than a boss doing the same thing to you. And I know that makes people uncomfortable when I make that comparison, but it's true. So I think we have to engage in all these groups. But I personally do not feel, particularly because I've come to realize that I have a very, you know, there are more popular left-wing podcasts out there by far. But what I say and do, actually, people do kind of take some seriousness, or they hate me. So what I have to think, if I endorse something, it's going to have an effect larger than me. So I don't feel like I can endorse anything right now. But I also don't feel strongly about condemning a whole lot, like out and out. You know, I wouldn't tell anyone to join Wedgar's Austin, but they don't exist anymore. You know,
right.
Anything emulating something like Shining Path or you know, like a Pol, or a Pol Pot fan club, you know, you should avoid those. I would also probably say, you know, avoid becoming a Marxist-Leninist, a.k.a. a Stalinist. But even there, You know, I tend to argue with those people. I would be cautious to condemn all of them. You know, I really would. I don't think, I honestly don't know that many people stay there for very long, but maybe I'm wrong about that. I hope I'm not, though. So just interact with people with an open and fair mind and learn what you can from any org you join or work with. And, you know, I think people need to have a broader view of what they're willing to work with than what they're willing to endorse. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like I'm willing to work with a lot of people and a lot of things. I'm not willing to endorse very much.
That makes sense. I mean, so there's the question you've been talking about just now, which is about, you know, the concrete question of which organization to join. But there's also a kind of slightly broader question about what mindset to have, right? Which is when you talked about learning something, to some people that's going to sound like, right, I join all these orgs, they're going to give me the input for the, you know, idealized labor tables or something, you know, and then, you know, boom, off we go. To change the world. I mean, we presumably think that way of looking at things is also bad.
No, that's dumb. You join in these groups or you work with these groups with both a specific goal. So you have I like to think of it from Trotsky's terms, a united front approach, not a popular front approach. You let your differences be known. You let your support be limited. And you engage with them knowing that they may change you and you may change them, but Neither way is going to be completely incomplete. I mean, completely complete or probably, yeah, lead you to revolution tomorrow. And I also think right now we have to have a priority of goals. I do think, for example, as much as green issues often annoy me, I think green issues are vital. I'm not a primitivist. I'm not one of those people who thinks that we have to be deep green and cut back and restrictivist on all questions. I don't. But We do have, like, the material world, we only live on this one. So, you know, it's something we have to handle. Next thing is work with, you know, I'm a big advocate of working with labor unions. I know people think I don't, but I am, and I do. But at the same time, do not think that a labor union is not structurally compromised. Like, and be honest about that. And be honest about that when you talk to people about them. You know, don't make promises that unions can do things, particularly in America, because Taft-Hartley really does change the tone dramatically. But everywhere, and, you know, unions are great. They're the best thing we have, but they're limited. They only deal with one element of our life. You know, they deal with our labor, which is something that in most things we tend to be democratic, except for on labor, where we tend to be autocrats, right? That public-private distinction. But and we let the private world be autocratic, and we shouldn't do that. At the same notion, like, don't think you're going to change everything about your life just because you're involved in a labor union. And a lot of people seem to talk like they do. They make it sound like it's almost a religious experience, and that's weird to me. Also, my last thing is don't think that any one philosophy, even Marxism, is going to give you all the answers to things. It's not. Marxism is not a total philosophy of everything. It's not. And if it is, it's a religion. And I'm, you know, I'd rather people who are religious just admit it. So, you know, that's where I stand. And I'm not, it's funny because people say, I'm not even anti-religious. I'm kind of religious myself. But it's one of those things where just admit that it's not going to give you all the answers. It's not like, you're not, like, for example, there is an ethical core to Marxism, but Marxism doesn't answer most of your ethical questions. It doesn't really tell you how to treat your girlfriend or your boyfriend, right? Like, it doesn't give you those answers. It can tell you what not to do to them and what to be aware about your relationship to them and the power dynamics that you have that you never thought about. It can inform it, but it's not going to answer that question for you. All it's going to give you is an additional vector to calculate.
To wrap up from my side, and we've often talked about having a broadly Adornian sensibility or a negative dialectical sensibility. And I think that if you listen back to this hour, the listeners will have gotten a better sense of what that means. There are a number of different things happening out there, a number of different movements, some more successful than others. Neither of us want to have any kind of global endorsement or of any of these groups. But the idea is to, I don't know, push push a few of these things as far as they can go and see what they reveal from the contradictions without having a kind of global view. That's, I think, the sort of most concrete sense I have about what these kind of references to Adorno mean for us.
Yeah, I mean, this is a dialectical thing, that it's a dialectic you enact, not just think. A way, that is my critique of Adorno, too. Like, I don't totally accept his ideas and resignation where a thought becomes its own, you know, manifestation of the dialectic. I think it's something you still have to do in the world. But his impulses and his negativity and the tensions there is something you do have to really deal with. And if you become completely positivistic or think you have a complete program. And I guess the one thing I'll caveat is people might hear me talk about, you know, limitations of knowledge and being intellectually humble and programmatically humble. That does not mean that you shouldn't adopt a program or join a party. As I said, the program's even more important in some ways. But I tend to think that the classical socialist way of understanding programs as min-max actually is probably the right way. Because you can articulate what you think we need to do to make things better for people in the immediate. You can't articulate how to get us to communism. You maybe, I might even give Trotskyists a point, even though I disagree with their, you know, if you have a minimum program and you also have some kind of transition, you might have something you can even start working on transitioning out. But saying that you know, this is sort of my disdain for the Paul Cockshots of the world, for example, who just think you can just calculate this with linear algebra and labor credits. Labor credits may be part of the solution. Linear algebra is probably, you know, like math will definitely be part of the solution. But I don't think you can know all the inputs and outputs from the moment that you're in. I don't think you can.
We'd like to thank you for listening to today's episode. Symptomatic Redness and Alternatives are produced for Zero Books by the team of C. Derek Varn, J.G. Michael, Amog Sahu, and Toby Kamir, our ever-faithful producer and editor. Please keep following us on the Inside Zero Books Patreon account for additional episodes. Have a good day.